Hi, everybody. Welcome to Sweater Weather. I'm Aaron Giovannone, a writer and professor.
I'm Naomi Lewis, a writer and editor.
We'll introduce our wonderful guest in a moment. Don't worry, I know he was scared. He had to say something. I didn't prepare him for this. So just first, a little bit about the show. Sweater Weather is a podcast about Canadian arts and culture. In long format discussions, we dive deep into Canadian literature, film, music, and more. The show is available on all major video, audio, and social media platforms. You can check out our Eventbrite page, too, for upcoming live shows like this one and to book your free tickets. This episode of Sweater Weather is recorded before a live audience at the Memorial Park Library in Calgary on Treaty 7 territory, home of the Siksika Nation, the Piikani Nation, the Kainai Nation, the Ithka Stoney Nakoda Nation, the Tsuut'ina Nation, and the Métis people of Alberta Region 3. Sweater Weather is made possible by the support of the Calgary Public Library, Calgary Arts Development, the Alberta Foundation for the Arts, and our audience. If you enjoy what we do, consider making a donation to the show on Patreon or PayPal. Your support is vital to sustaining the show, and it's very much appreciated. I think we should take a moment to thank one of our patrons, who's been a patron for a while on Patreon. I think you know her, Avon? Or is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah, Avon McMaster.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Avon, for your support. Okay, our topic today, singer-songwriter Ian Tyson. First as one half of the folk duo Ian and Sylvia, then as a solo country artist, Ian Tyson was a mainstay and then eventually a legend in Canadian folk and country music. We're going to be learning all about Ian Tyson today, but first let me introduce our guest, Jeremy Clauses. Jeremy's been a Calgary journalist for nearly two decades. He's the founder and editor-in-chief of The Sprawl, an independent news site that each month focuses on a specific issue in the city. He is also the ghostwriter of Ian Tyson's memoir, The Long Trail, My Life in the West, published in 2010. Please welcome Jeremy Clauses.
Thanks for having me.
Wonderful. Thank you, Jeremy. This is what we call this section opening thoughts, where we talk about maybe our earliest memories of or most vibrant encounters with Ian Tyson. Do you want to go, Jeremy, since you had the most direct experience?
Sure, yeah. I mean, my earliest encounter with Ian Tyson's music would be from my mom putting it on when I was a kid, growing up north of Edmonton in the 80s. And I remember... I mean, the song I remember most from my childhood, of course, is Navajo Rug, because that was on radio a lot. But yeah, that was my first encounter. It was just kind of on at home.
In the background. What are your first thoughts?
I actually didn't know anything about Ian Tyson, maybe because I didn't grow up in Alberta, but now I realize that's not much of an excuse. Until I moved to Edmonton and I went to the Edmonton Folk Festival, and he was actually playing, headlining at the Edmonton Folk Festival the first time I went. So,
yeah.
And he was clearly a big deal, and he ended the festival singing Four Strong Winds. Everyone sang along and like waved their candles, you know?
Right.
Yeah, so that was my first encounter with him.
I've never been to the Edmonton Folk Festival, but my understanding is that now it's the traditional final song for the whole festival every year, regardless of
whether he's there or not. Yeah, totally. So it was like a big deal that he was actually there singing it.
Right.
That did happen, right? I didn't dream that.
Yeah, I think so. And I've heard that about, I haven't been to the Edmonton Folk Fest either. So I need to go apparently.
Yeah, it is pretty great.
Yeah.
Well, when was my first encounter with Ian Tyson's work? Well, it was about 3 months ago.
Okay.
When I read Jeremy's wonderful obituary for Ian Tyson in The Sprawl. This is one of those moments when you understand how regional in many ways Canada is. Never heard of this guy. I knew the Four Strong Winds song just vaguely as a folk classic, but never really looked into who it was by and why it was important or anything. So, and I also just was not a country music fan. Coming from Ontario, that's where I was, you know, born and raised. I think this is the kind of music that your parents, for people our age, like our parents would have put it on, right? And my mom was not a country music fan, and she had some old folk records, kind of like Simon and Garfunkel and stuff. When I asked her about Ian Tyson preparing for the show, she said, oh yeah, like Ian and Sylvia. That was her experience of Ian Tyson just from the folk years in the 60s. Well, of course, getting into all those details. And once he went country, just kind of fell off my mom's radar. Really is like a thing. If you don't know country music, or maybe if you're not from the West, I think it would be easy to not know Ian Tyson if you're our age or younger. I think that's true. It was such a delight preparing for the show to discover this deep catalog, wonderful songwriting, just tremendous melodies and catchy choruses. This guy is just amazing. And so I've just had a blast doing the show. It's one of the pleasures of preparing for the show, is having time to just sit with an individual artist, or sometimes it's a book or a movie or something, and just spend time to indulge and take it all in.
So. And I have been there to observe Aaron becoming more and more of a fan over the last month.
It's impossible not to sing these songs to yourself. If you're listening to them, you're like,
yeah.
Hey, Mr. Vaquero. Just been singing that every 3 minutes. Singing
and
that
it's
to myself.
It's such a rich discography, like the different eras. Like there's so much to pull from. Yeah. From this weird reggae cowboy stuff to the Ian and Sylvia like folk, folk revival. Like all of it's fairly distinct and just kind of rich throughout.
Yeah,
there's not a lot of misses, I don't think.
That's what I was surprised by. Seeing such I think he had 17 albums. Maybe there's a few compilations I've thrown in there as well as a solo artist. And so just listening, I did listen to, I think, basically all of them. And I was surprised by how good each album was. And it was often distinct from the last one in its way, while still sounding like Ian Tyson. So should I, okay. Well, your book starts with Ian Tyson on his ranch. There's a pretty vivid scene.
A vignette of sorts.
Right. So relating an anecdote about getting one of his longhorn cattle like unstuck from a hay baler.
From a feeder.
So,
and swinging it around on his longhorns. Yeah.
Right, right.
Which apparently that's just another day at the ranch.
Did he take you around the ranch? I imagine you visited so often while writing the book. Right?
He did, yeah, just to get a feel for... the place. There's kind of two places there in terms of habitations or main buildings. There's the home place, which I was not familiar with that term, actually.
The home place.
It's called the home place. That's like your house.
Yeah.
And I, at one point, we had a dispute about that. And I was like, home place? I'm taking that out, like the house or whatever. He's like, no, it's the home place. That's a thing. So there's the home place, and then there's the stone house at his place, which was like this old, as the name suggests, stone house on a little hill where he did his recording and, his work.
Okay.
In that regard. But then, he took me around. He had, I think, another little... cabin further back, and all the, I don't know.
You see the animals?
Yes.
Yeah.
Saw some animals.
Did you see the longhorns?
I can't remember about the longhorns. I'm like not a ranch person at all. That's why it's weird that I was involved with this, to be honest.
A lot of battles over vocabulary, like home place and others.
Yeah. Not battles, just like, oh.
Discussions.
Now I know. I did not know.
Well, you get a cowboy voice in the book, I have to say. You know, you do get a... I imagine that was what he sounded like. I think you got a good... his voice pretty well.
Yeah. And his voice was like a mix of this Western cowboy voice. And then also pulling from this other side of his life, which was this being in New York, being in Toronto in the 60s. And like there was always that interesting... those interesting layers of his life and his approach to the work and just like everything. Like he had stacks of New Yorkers everywhere.
Right.
Like he's like, this is good writing. Like you want good writing, read the New Yorker.
Right.
And so he had stacks of those everywhere. And
he wasn't only reading the Calgary Herald.
He was not. Or Western Horseman would be another one. Yeah.
All right. Well, Ian Tyson was born in 1933. In Victoria. So his father, George, was an upper middle class Englishman who came to the Canadian West in 1906. He worked first as a ranch hand in Alberta. I guess he tried to have a homestead in on Vancouver Island somewhere. And eventually he settled down to like a nice white collar job. He was an insurance salesman, right? And they settled in Victoria. Any thoughts about his dad?
Well, they didn't get each other, his dad and him.
Okay.
Which is kind of on numerous levels. So Ian was interested in rodeo at first.
Yeah.
And his dad just like did not understand that. Why would you be doing that? And then later when Ian was in music, same kind of thing. And I'm trying to remember the term Ian used. I think he called it the leisure industry. My old man did not understand the leisure industry.
Yeah, right. It's like his father thought, or the impression I got from the book was his father was like, these are hobbies. They're not jobs.
Yeah, like kind of was like, why invest your time there type thing?
Yeah.
So Ian was always kind of chafing against that, I think, that parental, yeah.
Okay, yeah. He in the book, he said that he thought he and his dad were pretty similar. He quote, Ian speaking of his father, George, he approached life in a very visceral, non-intellectual way, always living in the moment and having fun. So I guess he was a traveling insurance salesman. You have to go out into the bush and sell insurance to lumberjacks. So it's like a life on the road that I think that he would... I mean, that Ian would also live in a lot of ways, right?
As a
trained musician.
Kind of echoed that.
I'm so interested, though, like as a ghostwriter myself, about the ghostwriting process. Like when I read stuff like that, I'm always like, did he really say that he and his father had a lot in common, or did Jeremy like coax that out of him?
No, like I think he would have said that. I mean, I don't have my notes in front of me,
course,
but yeah,
of course.
Yeah, I mean, it was constructed from his recollections,
right,
which I then sewed together.
I'm not saying you made it up.
No, I know. Yeah. I do remember for some parts where the memory was a little not as good.
Yeah.
I had to pull from like some old McLean's articles and interviews and stuff from the 60s.
Oh, okay.
But yeah.
Interesting.
Ian Tyson's mother, Margaret Campbell, was the daughter of a successful apothecary owner. That's the word used in the book, apothecary, in Victoria. Ian describes her as very Presbyterian and quite like religious or moral or strict or something. That's the vibe that I got about his mom. So Tyson's dad took him to his first rodeo in Vancouver when Ian was six. Ian was taken with an Indigenous cowboy, he didn't remember his name, who wore a purple satin shirt. And Ian had a chance to sit on the saddle on the horse, the cowboy's horse. And he said
he always remembered the shirts. It's kind of funny.
Yeah.
In his recollections, he's like, oh, yeah, this purple satin shirt. And then when he saw the Sons of the Pioneers, which was like a Western music act that came to Victoria, he's like, and they had the shirts with the snaps, like the Western shirts with the snaps. And he loved the shirts.
He was impressed with the pearl, what is it called? Like pearl buttons? Mother of pearl.
Yeah.
Mother of pearl buttons snaps on the one guy's sleeve. So he was turned to the audience. You could see these wonderful buttons up his arm.
Yeah.
And he loved it. He just loved that. So that was the first country music act that Tyson saw when he was 12 or 13. And I guess like the household was not particularly musical. He mentions hearing country music for the first time just on the radio, like a Nashville broadcast that he could pick up on the radio. Otherwise, his mother played a bit of piano, which was pretty standard for the time, but nobody was a musician.
Really. Yeah, I don't think so.
Yeah. Kind of amazing that he would go that route and be so clearly like a preternatural musician in a lot of ways. Although he didn't describe himself that way, did he?
No, and it's interesting now that we're talking about it to think back, because the story goes, by his telling, I learned to play guitar in Calgary after breaking my ankle at a rodeo in Cremona, I think, in 1956. And as I was recovering from this ankle injury, I picked up a guitar and learned to play Johnny Cash, I Walk the Line.
He said it was the guy in the hospital bed next to him that taught him how to play the guitar.
Yeah, yeah, totally. So like,
I've heard different versions of the story.
Yeah, yeah. Well, here, this is where we get into it. So I'm like, did you like, is that, I mean, that's a great story. Yeah. I'm not diminishing the story.
It's a wonderful story.
But yeah, he obviously had a gift. That makes me wonder if he was playing before to some degree. Maybe he just figured he started making it or hit a certain caliber at that time.
That's right. That's right. Because actually, yes. Yeah, so the story is that he was after the in the hospital after the rodeo injury, there was a room full of guys. One of them had a guitar. And so he was just sitting there incapacitated for several weeks. And so was just playing along to the radio. Right. But after that, he goes back to Vancouver. We'll get to why he's going to art school in Vancouver. And he mentions an aside, oh, I had actually played in a few shows with a couple, just like, he diminishes what he was doing, but he had already been performing as a musician in some capacity before that whole stint learning the guitar in Calgary. So you're right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I remember from the book, too.
Yeah.
He wasn't like, what's this thing? It's called a guitar.
I've never seen one of these before. How strange.
So Tyson was a poor student, a troublemaker. He was sent to boarding school, which made him worse in his own estimation. So his first cowboy experience was actually working in Banff over the summer. He was a cowboy guide, part of a group, for tourists who would make this trek from Banff to Mount
Assiniboine.
Yeah. So it's like a tourist cowboy experience or whatever. Can you still do that? I wonder. I'm sure you can do trips kind of like that. So after high school, he's working in the bush, and that's when he starts doing some of the rodeo stuff. Right. And eventually he will get hurt at rodeo. But while working in the bush, Tyson decided that he would go to art school. It's kind of a funny choice to make when you're like out in the forest. You're like, you know what I need to do now? I need to go to the Vancouver School of Art because it's maybe a lot easier than working in the bush would be my guess.
Yeah.
So that's Emily Carr University, right? So he said he wanted to draw horses and cowboys just as Will James did. Do you want to talk about Will James a little bit?
Yeah. So Will James was I'm trying to remember all the backstory. He wrote these books.
Yeah.
Essentially for kids, these cowboy books.
That's right.
These cowboy stories.
Yeah.
And Ian was always taken with the drawings in those books, like just the line, the clarity, the drama in these images of horses and cowboys.
Yeah.
He wrote a song about it later entitled Will James.
Yeah.
But this loomed large in his memory, these childhood books that he got from, I think, from his dad. So even with his dad, this was being fed. This imagination, this Western imagination was being fed by his father. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Will James was the pseudonym of a French Canadian author. His name was Ernest Dufaux. And but he had always sort of kind of hid his origins and tried to put a Texas accent on. So yeah, I mean, I think Tyson would be very concerned with authenticity in like of the cowboy lifestyle, how that translates into music. But from the very beginning, like much of the cowboy culture that he's inculcated with is very performative. It is people assuming a new identity and like pretending to be a cowboy in a way that they're not. And so it's an interesting dynamic.
That starts right away.
Right away.
Yeah, yeah. And that is very much a part of, Ian's story.
Yeah.
In terms of him reinventing himself in these different eras and places, but also just the quote unquote cowboy experience.
That's right.
Like even if you go down by Longview, a lot of the cowboying that happens there is because of movies. Seriously, like it's the movies that are being shot down there. So it's like that. Yeah. That's
so interesting. And Longview is where Ian Tyson ended up living, right?
Yeah, he was east of Longview,
okay.
His ranch. But yeah, like so 10 minutes east.
There are like ranches that just have horses that they rent out to movie sets, right?
Like they. Like John Scott is one of the big ones. And it's like, you know, Clint Eastwood, Unforgiven, and stuff like that from way back when. And then John Scott, I think, like, went to New Zealand to help with Lord of the Rings, and then, you know, The Revenant and all this stuff happens. He's involved with that.
Yeah.
So you have these working cowboys who are working because of, you could say, contrivance or artifice or the portrayal of...
Yeah. You know. It's like it's become a simulacrum.
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh. That's so... weird and interesting.
Yeah. Well, he's in Vancouver now. He's in his early 20s. He had an intense romance with Evinia Poulos, a young woman from the Okanagan, from, I think, from Vernon. She was of Greek heritage. It was a tumultuous relationship. She left school and moved to California. And this was the inspiration for the first song that Ian Tyson would write in his own account. Four Strong Winds, which was inspired by this relationship. As they're partying, especially. You know, I think the lyrics go, I'll look for you if I'm ever back this way. And Tyson described Poulos, in this book, he describes her as his soulmate in 2010. And elsewhere, I noticed he said, quote, we've been lovers for 55 years, which he said in like 2012.
So yeah, I didn't get that for the book. He talked to a McLean's reporter after but okay.
He kind of implied it, but like he clearly, like the reason their relationship was tumultuous seemed to be because he was sleeping with other people. Like, is that fair?
Yeah, I think that's something that was kind of happening throughout.
Yeah.
It's my impression as
He's
well.
Like, I don't know what happened. Our relationship is crazy.
So that was a romance that never went away entirely. I mean, it came back in his final years. I watched a 2012 documentary. Do you remember this one, Jeremy? Did you see it? It's called Something the Gravel Road, From the Gravel Road.
Yeah.
You can see bits of it on YouTube. And Evinia's there.
Yeah,
she's like
she would
by
visit him on the ranch.
Yeah. So, so into his like last decade, right?
Yeah.
So. That was, it's kind of funny because Four Strong Winds is like such a tragic kind of parting song, but in fact they would, I guess, never really be, separated. Not permanently anyway. Okay. So summers during art school, Tyson returned to Banff to work as a cab driver. Evenings he'd gamble with the other students there for the summer and he would lose most of what he earned. And this was the inspiration for the song Summer Wages. Okay, so I've not done this before, but I thought maybe we should listen to a little bit of Summer Wages. Is that okay?
Yeah.
All right, let's do this.
And that's a good one.
I love that one.
Never hit 17 when you play against the dealer. Oh, you know that the odds won't ride with you. Never leave your woman alone when your friends are out to steal her. Years are gambled and gone like summer wages. And we'll keep rolling on till we get to Vancouver and the woman that I love who's living there. It's been 6 long months and more since I've seen her. Maybe gambled and gone like summer wages. In all the beer parlors all down along Main Street, the dreams of the seasons are all spilled.
What stands out to you about this song, Summer Wages? I'll say I found it, never heard the song before 2 weeks ago. And I was just like listening to it as I was like on my bike, at like my stationary bike at home. And I was like, this song's awesome. I love this song. And I was also thinking, this sounds kind of like another song I do know, which is that Gambler song. The Gambler by Kenny, that Kenny Rogers made famous. I forget who wrote The Gambler, but I looked it up. This song was well before The Gambler. So I assume this had an influence on that other song, The
Maybe.
Gambler. Yeah.
I never considered that.
It's kind of funny, this story, but like it sounds like an old, wow, it's like an old time Western saloon scene where these tough guys are like playing like blackjack and they probably got a six shooter on their side or whatever. Maybe that's just my romantic projection. But then you hear the story behind it. It was a bunch of summer students like working at the Banff Springs Hotel, you know, like in the basement.
And such a good line, the dreams of the season all spilled out on the floor, or get spilled out on the floor.
Great.
Great.
What a wonderful image. Yeah, like the I guess the chips or the money or whatever.
Yeah.
Any thoughts about summer wages?
Sorry.
And this is one of the ones that goes across his eras. Like there's an Ian and Sylvia cut.
That's what we heard. What we heard was the Ian and Sylvia cut. And he does it again in the 80s.
Yeah. On his own. On Cowboyography. Yeah.
That's right. So he goes back to Vancouver after having hurt his ankle, and he starts playing in a rockabilly band. This was a big genre at the time. And he mentions in the book that his band opened for Buddy Holly one time. So he was getting into music more seriously at that point. He has a brief moment working on pipelines in Kamloops or near Kamloops. He did try to train horses for a while, right? He was, what do they call it? Like I feel like such a poser trying to like use the proper Western terminology for stuff. It was like, was he breaking broncos for a while?
Breaking Bronx. Yeah, that's the language he would use. Yeah. And that's the language he would use in the song Will James.
Right.
Exactly. Breaking so you're okay.
Breaking Bronx. All right. Yeah. All right.
That's
so
what it is.
He hitchhikes out to Toronto. So, cause he wants to get more into music, right? He's pursuing his musical career. He is a trained art school. Like he graduated from art school. So he works as an illustrator at Star Weekly, and elsewhere. Yeah.
Oh yeah. I was going to ask what kind of art he made. He was an illustrator.
So he went to art school hoping to do the kind of Western style art of Will James and another
Charlie Russell
is another influence you mentioned. So this is like representational art, right? It's like pictures of horses and landscapes. And of course, in the 50s at Vancouver Art School, like that was not what they were studying. They were studying post-impressionism. So like more abstract and less representational. So he was like,
what is this crap?
He suggests
you can picture him, you know?
He does not sound so dismissive in the book.
No?
And I don't know if he was in person more like these elite abstract artists or something. I don't know if he would have had that attitude.
Yeah,
I don't remember
about that. I do remember he designed a poster for a folk fest.
Mariposa?
Yes, that sounds right.
Yeah.
And he was proud of that, and it was still in his kitchen.
It won an award, he said in the book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he was good. Did he ever do his own artwork on his albums? Did he ever do that?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I could be wrong. But his later ones especially, he had a friend who did all the artwork. Paul Rasperich, his name is.
Okay, yeah, because I noticed it looked consistent.
Mm-hmm.
It was a similar style. So Tyson describes like playing the coffee house folk music scene in Toronto as it's very easy, actually. He says it was an easy scene to get into because there are more coffee houses than musicians. I mean, we're in the like the late 50s at this point, right? And so he could make $15 for one gig and only had to pay $7 a week for rent. So you're coming out ahead there. Like that's pretty good. You're doing pretty well. Now, while he's in Toronto, a friend in the music scene introduced Tyson to another young folk musician. Her name was Sylvia Fricker. I'm assuming, like, I think you have more detail in the book about this, but the intention was, like, this is potentially a musical partner for you? Is that the idea of the meeting?
I think so, yeah. And I don't know if it was necessarily laid out that clearly at the outset, but that's quickly what it became,
right,
which was very of the moment, very trendy to have these folk duos, which I don't know. Has anyone seen A Mighty Wind?
I was just thinking of that.
I get a real kick out of that movie, and Ian did too. I asked him about him, like, this is funny, isn't it? And he's like, oh yeah, I thought it was great. But that film kind of captures that era.
Yeah, and like there's the duo that's Eugene Levy and what's her name?
Oh, Catherine O'Hara.
Yeah. As a former kind of like, folk duo who were married and have since split up and then have to play together again.
Do a reunion concert. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
I don't know if they spoof in the movie playing strange instruments as part of the folk revival.
Yeah, yeah. So she plays the auto harp.
The auto harp, which, yeah.
Which Sylvia played.
Totally.
Yeah, I noticed that in the book. I was like, the auto harp, that's like in A Mighty Wind.
That's so right. I've seen concert films of Sylvia with that harp. That's like the tiny harp, right?
No, it's large. It's like a...
But it's like she's holding it.
Yeah, yeah,
though,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
It's not like a harp on
the
ground.
No, yeah.
Like
compared to a normal harp, it's small.
But you press like buttons that have like the notes written on them or something?
I don't even know. Yeah. That's a good question.
Because I remember reading, this is a tangent, but I read a novel like ages when I was a kid about kind of the folk scene, and like the character was making fun of the auto harp as like not a real instrument.
Well, Tyson says that when they met, Sylvia played, quote, a weird little mandocello. A mandocello is similar to a mandolin, but it's actually larger than a mandolin, I guess. So she was already playing a strange instrument. Tyson says he never saw one again. Yeah. Like it was the first time.
First and last time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the two become a musical duo. Tyson would generally sing the lead, almost always. Sylvia would harmonize because she had better control of her voice. Later, a review in the New York Times, when they're, you know, popular, would call them, quote, one of the finest blends of male and female voices in the folk revival. It's 1961 now. It's 1961. That's when Ian and Sylvia are doing well in the Toronto scene. They headline the first ever Mariposa Folk Festival in Orillia, which is like still a thing, right? I mean, I've never been, but should we listen to an Ian and Sylvia a little bit? All right, let's listen to a little bit. Someday soon. This is from 1964. So, the story of a no-good rodeo rider boyfriend. Think he pulled from his own life for that? Or it's kind of funny, right? That song would be a big hit for in the 90s for a country artist named Susie
Bogus. Yeah.
Bogus.
Yeah.
I would have said Bogus.
Yeah, yeah.
But it is Bogus.
Bogus, yeah.
And it was a big hit, and Tyson got like a big royalty check for that in the 90s.
Another good cover.
It is a good cover, isn't it? Yeah, from a woman singing it too, obviously.
Yeah.
But any thoughts on Someday Soon, the story of a rodeo rider boyfriend?
I always get it mixed up with Summer Wages, to be honest.
Yeah.
I don't know why. I think because like they're both... I'm trying to remember if it's on Cowboyography. But anyway, there's an Ian and Sylvia version, and then it's like also a really good Ian Tyson version of this song.
Yeah.
Yeah. Such a good one.
Yeah, I love that one. And their harmony, of course, right? So
I would just say, like, these songs strike me as better than Four Strong Winds.
Yeah.
Like, same. I know everybody loves Four Strong Winds, but like, give me Someday Soon anytime over Four Strong Winds. That's all.
I agree with that too. Yeah. Which one would you choose, Naomi? You have to choose right now.
Well, I mean, I think it's true that the one we just heard is like better, like more complex and interesting, but yeah. It also makes sense that the catchier, more sort of straightforward song, both like melodically and emotionally, would be the one that was the big hit, mm-hmm. I think.
Mm-hmm. Has kind of universal themes, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
So, okay, in 1962, Ian and Sylvia are in New York. Sylvia lived there. Ian went back and forth to Toronto. In his own words, he was juggling various girlfriends, apparently. Among the big names they knew in the like the New York coffee house scene was Bob Dylan before he was really big or getting big. There are different versions of this story, but Tyson has said that he heard Bob Dylan play Blowin' in the Wind, and then the next day he turned around and wrote Four Strong Winds. Mm-hmm. So in the book, he admits that, actually, maybe I don't know what song it was Bob Dylan played that day. I don't know if it was the other wind song or not. But that was his story for you.
Yeah, yeah. He heard Dylan play something and figured, oh, well, if this guy can do it, I can do it.
That's right.
And, of course, Bob Dylan was not yet of the stature that he would become as a musician and as a performer. So yeah. It was a very interesting ecosystem, thinking of Greenwich Village
yeah.
at that time. Like, I remember him describing how people would just be going out into the square. I'm trying to remember where, Washington Square somewhere, and like doing these bluegrass jams, like getting in a circle and playing bluegrass, and you were trying to keep up and like trying to play along and outdo one another. And there was just this very lively, organic performance / community thing happening. So yeah, at these coffee houses, you'd see somebody and then be like, oh, I could do a version of that or better.
Yeah, it sounds very inspiring. A very nice community to be a part of. It's been claimed that Tyson was the one who turned Dylan onto pot. This is what is said. Now, how did he feel about that story? He didn't want to be known as like a pot smoker.
Not really. Yeah, not like a Willie Nelson, for example, where it's like part of his brand and who he is.
Yeah.
But, and in fact, he was foggy on the details of that, but he's like, oh, in this book by, I think, Susie Rodolo is the name, who did a book about Bob Dylan. She says that I turned Bob Dylan onto pot. He's like, okay, sure, I'll go along with it. But like his own recollection on that point wasn't,
So they get, Ian and Sylvia get a record deal through their manager, Alan Grossman, who also managed Dylan, kind of famously managed Bob Dylan. From 1962 to 1968, Ian and Sylvia released 7 albums. That's like one per year.
Yeah, they cranked them out.
Really cranked them out. 1964 was the peak of their chart performance with the album that we just heard a cut from called Northern Journey. They always were playing up the Canadian thing too. Like on that album, Northern Journey, it is implying, oh yeah, we're from Canada, this northern place, maybe a place of certain kinds of authentic country style or folk style experiences. There's songs like the Nova Scotia. There's obvious references to Canada. So that was always kind of part of their identity, I think.
At what point did they become a couple?
Right now.
Oh.
So they're very successful in 1964, but in particular, they played the Newport Folk Festival. They did like a whole circuit of American colleges. They sold out Carnegie Hall. And that year in the summer, Ian and Sylvia got married. Tyson says, quote, "While our affection for each other was very real, the truth is that Sylvia and I had completely different interests." He mentions that, you know, he was a country guy and she really liked the city. "Had we not been inextricably bonded by our musical careers, we wouldn't have been married." That's what he said years later. In 1965, Tyson bought a small cattle farm near Bowmanville, Ontario, with some horses, and he had someone running it. He hired someone to run it. Did he live there? That like sometimes he lived there. Did Sylvia live there?
That's a good question. I don't know, because I think there's a lot of touring and whatnot going on. Obviously.
That's right.
So
yeah,
I think there's a back and forth.
Right.
Yeah.
But he got a ranch. He wanted like a farm, so he got one. I guess not technically a ranch. Can ranches only be in the West? In the East, are they farms?
That's a good question. As to the technical definition of a ranch.
Yeah, no, I'm sure people out there are like, I know what a ranch is.
Yeah, yeah.
These city slickers don't know what a ranch is.
Yeah.
So in 1966, Sylvia gave birth to their son, Clay. The folk scene was increasingly political as the 60s wore on, especially around the issue of the Vietnam War. Ian and Sylvia were not interested in politics, however. So Tyson said, Sylvia felt that protest music was good protest, but bad music. And I felt similarly. I never went along with the Woody Guthrie socialism and union stuff. But Tyson mentions he was against the war, but because of his U.S. green card, he had to register for the draft, but he dreaded being called up. He wasn't called up, but he mentions that some people he knew did go to the war and were killed. Any thoughts about that, though? Like, yeah, because the folk scene was pretty political in a lot of ways.
And doesn't they just he kind actually of say he was anti-union?
Like, yes, he does.
Yeah.
He does, in a certain context. He said amongst the men, working men he knew, like loggers and cowboys and stuff, like they didn't have any, the union didn't do any good for them in his experience. And he saw that there was union corruption and stuff, which I understand. Yeah. I understand the argument, yeah.
Yeah, for a moment I was like, isn't there a thing in A Mighty Wind about the politics of folk bands? There might be, but what I'm thinking of is Johnny Cash has a song, The One on the Right is the One on the Left or something, and making fun of like the folk music politics. But yeah, Ian's view was very much like, I'm not getting into it.
It's kind of interesting though to think about that, how at that time it would have been, I mean, he seems to say, maybe I misunderstood, but that it was like a bad for his career that he wasn't more political. That there was a lot of pressure.
Yeah, yeah. Like, it was an avenue, I think,
you could
go, but not... Yeah, I don't think it was one he was ever comfortable with, like, whether in the first era, like the folk era, or the cowboy era.
Yeah, it makes so much sense to think about if you were a folk singer during the Vietnam War and you didn't, in the States especially, and you didn't want to say anything about it, like, you kind of become... irrelevant.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and arguably by that time, their star was fading.
Yeah.
And by Ian's telling, which is oversimplified, he's like, oh, the Beatles played Ed Sullivan, and that was it. In 1964, the Beatles played, and then we were done.
Right.
And like...
rock music was now ascendant.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Which is... there's a degree of truth to it in terms of, you know... the culture shifting and whatnot. But yeah, Ian and Sylvia played for a while after that.
Right.
And I had to kind of extract that out of him. I'm like, no, it wasn't, you didn't just have a few good years. Like, it was longer than your recollection.
Right, right. And didn't he have a TV show?
We're getting there, yeah. Oh,
sorry,
yeah,
I keep jumping ahead.
No, that's okay. So the way they evolve musically, they end up like moving towards country rock. In the late 60s, Ian and Sylvia, they went to Nashville and they recorded some kind of more country-inspired records, including 1968's Full Circle. And in 1970, together, Ian and Sylvia put like a band together called Great Speckled Bird. And this was a country rock outfit. And they went on tour. They were like on a cross Canada tour on the train with the Grateful Dead and the band. And
there's a tale, which may be a tall tale... of Ian getting in a fist fight with somebody outside the Cecil Hotel and breaking his, I don't know, finger or something as part of that tour. I don't know. They pulled up beside someone and things were exchanged. Anyway, a little bit of like local history trivia.
Yeah. All right. So this is we're approaching the end of the Ian and Sylvia years. Do you want to listen to a song by Great Speckled Bird? Called Long, Long Time to Get Old.
Yeah.
Let's listen to this.
Let's do it.
The eagle's flying tomorrow, mosquito biting me today. I ride the bus to Toronto, a highway 2 all the way. I take a walk along Yonge Street. A good time's a bought soul. Remember this, children, if the good Lord's willing, live a long, long time to get old. I aim it back to the hometown,
The liquor store burned down. My old girlfriend arrived way on the east end of town. Oh, and she laughed when she passed me, and I knew I'd been told. She said, remember these children, if the good Lord's willing, live a long, long time to get old.
I feel like Ian and Sylvia thing is not gonna, it's not gonna end well.
He says that other woman was his soulmate the whole time, so.
Yeah, yeah, that's
that may
probably
be
a factor in there.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
It's funny because when he's talking about her name's Avinia, right?
Avinia?
Avinia. When he's talking about her being a soulmate, he's like, she had her other men, I had my other women, but it was always, we were each other's main person or whatever. But it's like you were married to someone else. It seems like I had my women. It's a bit of an understatement.
Mm. So in the early 70s, Tyson is starting to do his own thing more and more. So he's hosting a weekly half-hour country music show on CFTO-TV. That's CTV in Toronto. It was called Nashville North. Later, they called it the Ian Tyson Show. And so Tyson would play some songs, and he would welcome country music guests like Willie Nelson and Dolly Parton. They were guests on that show. He's doing that primarily by himself. Sylvia would show up occasionally to sing along. But Tyson had been drifting creatively and personally from the Ian and Sylvia duo. He writes, or maybe Jeremy writes. Quote.
You'll never know.
Quote, my goal was to find a good generic country music sound, a radio-friendly style, and there was no way I could do that in the context of our duo. He continues, the duet is a pretty restrictive format because you always have to blend and there's little room for extemporaneous vocals. And it's also true that the duet was just going out of fashion. Like, it was already it had been done a lot in the 60s, and it was sort of done now.
Yeah, these folk duos that the sun was setting on that era.
That's
by
right.
This time.
Yeah. But so Tyson released a solo country album in 1973 called Old Eon. I couldn't find it on Spotify. Have you ever heard
that? Oh, I've heard it. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Old Eon. And that's what we call in my home.
Oh.
When we talk about Ian, we always say Old Eon. Listening to Old Eon, put on some Old Eon. But yeah, that record, I can't say I've listened to it much.
Yeah.
But you can hear him trying to find this new sound.
Yeah. So the record didn't really get much notice. And Tyson admits to being jealous of the success of Gordon Lightfoot and Stompin' Tom Connors at this time. Stompin' Tom won the Juno for Best Country Musician 4 years in a row from 71 to 75. Tyson said, Jeremy wrote, I didn't identify with his music. I also thought that the Toronto crowd's acceptance of his work, speaking of Stompin' Tom, was pretty condescending and patronizing. To me, it seemed they regarded Connors' material as hick music. So my grandmother did like Stompin' Tom Connors, actually. I do remember that. But Tyson also admits that he was jealous. Mm-hmm. He was just sort of jealous of others' success. So I guess in 1975, there's a definitive end to his marriage with Sylvia. Tyson had an affair with radio host Katie Malick. And so he and Sylvia divorced later that year.
Is she the Katie in Navajo Rug?
That's a good question.
No, because the Katie in Navajo Rug is a diner waitress.
In the
story, right? But
that's
it's
true.
Just also a great name, Katie. Who wrote the lyrics for Navajo Rug? Because I know that song was co-written with Tom
Russell.
Russell.
Yeah, I'm not sure if one or the other, they did it together.
Okay.
Katie's.
It's that Katie or another Katie out there. So Tyson started to seriously cowboy. Is that a verb? Can you use that as a verb? To cowboy?
I think you can.
Come on, you've watched Yellowstone.
I think it is used maybe as a verb in the book at certain points.
Okay.
I don't know. Yeah.
Well, I'm going with it.
Yeah, go
I
with
feel
it,
like man. In a lot of movies and TV shows, it's used as a verb.
Okay, well, through some cowboy friends, Tyson, he began cutting. So he's doing that rodeo event that involves a rider and a horse separating a cow from the herd, singling it out. And it's a difficult procedure because cows have a strong herd instinct and they're always trying to get back. And actually, speaking of Yellowstone, the wonderful Paramount Network drama. Do you ever watch that?
I haven't, to be honest.
I think it's technically the most popular show on television right now. And it's all about, yes, it's about the kind of the romance of a ranch life and of cowboying. And you see that actually depicted quite frequently on that show. This is very skillful because you see the horse like going back and forth following the cow who's trying to get around him. And you're like, whoa, this is really kind of amazing. It's very balletic, actually. So Tyson starts getting into that, and he acquired some cutting horses of his own. And he talks about being particularly enamored of a quarter horse named Doc Abel Mabel that was the daughter of a champion cutting horse named Doc Barr from Arizona. And this was one of his prize horses early on, right?
Yes, and I'm laughing because I remember at that part of the book... He really wanted to go into like the lineages of these different horses. And I'm kind of looking at this like,
I could totally tell too, because there's just enough in there. You're like, oh, you get a sense that Tyson is just, he's really loves horses. He knows all about them. He talks about them all the time. Right. Yeah. And you are just like trying to get just the right amount in the book. But you could tell there's so much more.
Oh, totally.
Like, so much more.
And he
more
just like it. Wanted to go full on. And I'm like, I don't know. Like for the lay person, Ian Tyson fan, who's not, you know, into horse breeding, this might be a little much. But that said, it was a part of the book that he was enthusiastic about. So that was good. Like he wrote a bunch of that section by hand, actually.
Oh,
that's good.
So he was like, this is important. So
he wasn't so forthcoming about his affairs.
No, or even he didn't want to chat much about Ian and Sylvia, like how they got together. He was quite brief on certain points like that. But yeah, when it comes to horses.
That's such a challenge as a ghostwriter because, you know, like, yeah, when the person wants to talk less about the stuff that people are going to want to read, right? And more about their own obsession.
Yeah, and then it's like, okay, how do I extract this from this person?
Yeah.
A challenge. Interesting challenge.
So Tyson says of his fascination of horses, he said, when you spend all of your time with horses, you want to understand them fully, but you can't. And that's the mystery that fascinates us. It is ultimately a creature that it's an animal and you can't fully understand or control it, right? That's the fantasy of the vaquero, I guess, the master horseman who can, you know, put a handle on this pony for me so I can just control the horse
magically. Teach me the mystery.
Teach me the mystery.
That's the line, yeah.
So Tyson goes to Nashville, he cuts some demos, but he doesn't get a record deal. He's, I mean, it's mentioned in the book that Tyson had the reputation of being difficult to work with.
Yes, this is a theme throughout.
Like he wouldn't want to, just he just wouldn't follow direction from the label, I guess. Is that one of the things?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember that part, but that sounds, checks out.
He also didn't want to sit on a tour bus for 300 days a year.
Mm.
That's what he also said.
Yeah.
Okay. But he probably ended up doing that anyway, ultimately. Like touring a lot? Or
yeah,
later
a
on?
Lot.
Not to that extent.
Not to that extent, yeah.
So Tyson, he wanted to move to Texas and buy a ranch now that he's divorced. This is a funny... Okay, this story is kind of funny. I feel like this may be... Okay, well, let me just tell the story. Okay, but Tyson had a blemish on his record for having to do with a marijuana charge. His guitar case had been shipped after a show with marijuana joints in it, and it had been discovered by the RCMP. In Canada, the charge had been dropped, but like for U.S. authorities, it meant that his green card would be revoked, so he couldn't like live in the United States after that. Now, I just think it's funny. His story is that, oh, some groupies must have thrown some marijuana in my guitar case, as if that wouldn't be the way you like ship marijuana.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
You would throw it in the guitar case so it's not on your person, right?
Yeah.
Anyway. Not that I've ever done that.
Yeah, of course not.
And it's all legal now, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
You know who turned me onto pot?
Willie Nelson.
Justin Trudeau did, as soon as it became legal.
There you go.
So Tyson, he moved to Alberta instead. just as he threatened to do in the song Four Strong Winds. He did the exact same thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think he'd been planning it all along in a way. I mean, he said it and it's like, I'll move out to Alberta. I think the lyrics are, there's someone I can work with. Like I can work on his ranch.
Yep.
That's what he does. So he goes to Alberta. He, I guess he said that in the 70s on tour with Great Speckled Bird, he'd played Ranchman's, the famous honky tonk bar, and he fell in love with a sunset over the Rocky Mountains. So one of his, one of the reasons he wanted to move here. So in 1978, Tyson moved to a ranch in Pincher Creek, 200 kilometers south of Calgary. Tyson was entering his, quote, middle-aged crazies, which involved lots of horses, whiskey, and women. He partied with his friend Alan Young. There's a picture of Alan Young in the book, who managed the ranch in Pincher Creek for, I believe, French entrepreneurs is how they're described. So wealthy French folk own this ranch. Alan Young is managing it, and Tyson's living there and learning, I guess, working the horses and stuff too, right?
And loving it.
And loving it.
It was kind of a respite from, he was just kind of unmoored in Toronto in the 70s. Like, he'd come off the high of the Ian and Sylvia and then doing the show. He's watching Gordon Lightfoot, who was a mentee of Tyson's. Gordon Lightfoot's the big thing. So he's watching all this stuff happen. He's pretty disillusioned is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And then comes out, starts working at this ranch,
Pincher
Creek, and is like, okay.
He's spending more time with doing ranch stuff, cowboy stuff, horse stuff. Like he's doing less music really at this time. Although he mentions, go ahead.
He is still recording.
Oh, he is.
Amidst this.
Oh, yeah, he is.
He, he doesn't set it aside, entirely.
Right.
He's kind of picking away at it. Yeah.
Okay. He's playing regularly at Ranchman's. He'd get a week-long stint there, and he'd get paid $5,000, as he said, for a week of shows. So he did this for many years, well into the 80s. But he grew to dislike it. He claimed that the crowds didn't listen to the music. They were too drunk, and they were too rowdy. And Tyson also admits that he always drove home drunk from Ranchman's.
Yes, he admits this.
Another era when that stuff wasn't policed so much, I guess.
And this is another thing where a question of his memory.
Okay.
Because in his recollection, I played these Ranchman shows and it was terrible and no one listened. They were there to drink. They weren't there for the music. But I've heard from people since who are like, no, those were good shows. Like, and people were paying attention. So he had this tendency, I think, to, I don't know, be a little dismissive of certain past eras of his career. It's like, no, it wasn't actually as bad as you recall.
Yeah, I mean, he's like, he has that tone about Ranchman's. He also does have that tone about Ian and Sylvia, too. Mm-hmm. Like, he often is very, he is a little dismissive of, they're obviously great achievements from the era. It is kind of interesting. I think he wanted also to foreground like what he was doing now.
Exactly.
Or most recently was the best and was the most important.
Yeah, because he was a true artist. Like he was he wasn't mailing it in and, let's just do the greatest hits. Like he was trying to, he was trying to fuse reggae and Western music, like kind of some weird stuff.
Yeah.
But he was an artist. Like, he was thinking like that. And he...
Yeah.
Yeah.
At Ranchman, something very important happened as well. He met... Is it Twyla?
Twyla.
That's how you say it. Twyla Dvorkin? Dvorkin?
Dvorkin, yeah.
Dvorkin. She was a waitress. She was 17. He was 45. The two were romantically involved. Eventually, they lived together. They had a daughter, and they got married.
I did not realize she was 17 and he was 45. That's
a little bit of an age difference.
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah. So in 1978, Neil Young covered Four Strong Winds. And Tyson, at that point, owned all of the rights and he could claim all of the royalties. And so he got a big chunk of cash with which he bought. He also sold his Ontario farm and used this money to buy the ranch east of Longview, about an hour south of Calgary, just off of the Cowboy Trail. He did this in 1978. He's got his own outfit now. Pretty nice. Twyla moved in, and together they began the T Bar Y Ranch. Is that how it said? T Bar Y?
T Bar Y, yeah.
T Bar Y Ranch. Twyla worked in high-end retail in Calgary, and then, as it's described in the book, would hammer fence posts with Ian on the weekends. In Longview, Tyson made friends and drinking buddies with local cowboys, who most of them were also artists as well. Like the cowboy lifestyle you mentioned, mm-hmm. is you can't really. It's also linked inextricably to arts and culture, to performance. Mm-hmm. So a lot of them were like sculptors and painters.
Yeah, and there's right? a lot of them still down there.
Right.
Like Yale Gallup and a few others who like do stuff for Stampede, or you go to the Calgary airport and you'll see some of these,
yeah.
The work of these sculptors. So yeah, there's like a cohort of them down there.
You were, I mean, I don't know if this is the right time to ask, like you were in Longview recently mm-hmm. at like an Ian Tyson Memorial event, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah. Yeah, there was kind of an informal memorial for people in the ranch community and in the music community at the Longview Saloon, which was pretty cool.
Was that his hangout? That's the saloon he'd referenced going to, the bar, the local?
That's a good question.
Because he talks about going to the bar in Longview and not
that
really.
That would be the place.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. I'm not sure.
There's only one, right?
I think.
Okay.
I don't know. Need to go on a field trip. Check. A pub crawl. Longview pub crawl.
Yeah. the cowboy trail pub crawl?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that might, yeah, I don't know. You're not allowed to drive drunk anymore.
Yeah, yeah, unfortunately.
You can ride a horse.
You can, oh, is there a law against that? Riding a horse drunk?
But if you do go to Longview, the place to go is the steakhouse. Longview Steakhouse.
Okay.
Which I'm told now has very, like, you got to reserve well in advance.
Oh, wow.
To get in.
Oh.
So
I'm
just saying, Longview Steakhouse. It's a good.
I bet you it's full of city slickers.
Yeah, yeah.
From the city going down there on the weekend.
That's jerks.
So Tyson at this time is like, I mean, I guess this was always there, but he's like, ever more immersed and enamored with the West, with cowboy culture. In the winters, Ian and Twyla would travel through the American West and Southwest, just going to small towns, as he described, small cow towns, hanging out at bars and saloons, getting to know the area, and then moving on after a few days. And this would be like a vacation for them. Twyla encouraged Tyson to begin recording music again. I guess get into it more. So in 1983, he released the album Old Corrals and Sagebrush. The album was, according to Tyson, a cowboy album through and through. Love this album.
So good.
I love this album so much. What do I know about this? But it's like, this feels so pure and authentic and clean cowboy. Like it just.
Oh yeah. You can hear it clicking on that album for sure. More than the previous one, I think, was One Jump Ahead of the Devil, which was kind of a mishmash of some, different feel. But Old Corrals and Sagebrush, you start to hear that real country western kind of locked in sound. I think he co-wrote some songs with Tom Russell on that one as well, who he would continue to write with. And a lot of that, Old Corrals and Sagebrush, came out of him working at this Pincher Creek ranch. So
this is mentioned, like in the 80s, cowboy culture experienced a boom. Suddenly, everybody was wearing cowboy hats at the bar. I mean, that's kind of Tyson's memory of it. Whether they were really, cowboys or not. Country music, as a consequence, had a larger audience. Also mentions a John Travolta movie, Urban Cowboy, that was, like, I guess, quite a hit at the time.
In 1980, I believe.
Right on 1980. Like, the 80s, you do see a bout of nostalgia. For the 50s, especially for the 50s. That's a time when Western, films and television are like very popular, right? Like Reagan, President Reagan, he was a Western movie actor, right? Among other things. And so he's the president then, very much define the age. And even think about 50s nostalgia in a movie not cowboy, Back to the Future, where it's about going back from the 80s to the 50s. So the cowboy boom benefited Tyson's country career, as we'll see. He was also at times skeptical of this. He writes, "I think that's why I started emphasizing authenticity so much in my music. There were too many fakes around." How do you think Tyson does that? what does he think of as authentic in his music? One thing I notice is he wants to tell specific stories. Mm-hmm. So there, he's always mentioning, he's telling the story of a particular saddle, mm-hmm. or a particular cowboy or a particular ranch. And he's not afraid to just use the place names and the proper names and use terminology, vocabulary that I do not know what it means. I go mm-hmm. look it up, like, what is a cavy? Oh, a cavy is a group of horses. Okay, I didn't know. I heard of horses.
Yeah.
I didn't know. I mean, maybe I should know that, but I didn't know that.
Yeah.
So what do you think about Tyson's authenticity?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the interesting tensions in his life, I think, was that he was aware of all this stuff happening around the cowboy mythology, like movies, and that's how he got pulled into it, was, yeah. you know, Sons of the Pioneers, seeing them in Victoria, seeing... blanking on the name, but seeing old westerns, Tex Ritter, maybe?
Ritter, that was it.
Yeah. So there's this portrayal, this romantic portrayal of the West that in turn pulls you into the real thing. And he, I think, part of what gave his work his power was he understood the tensions and the interplay between those two things. Like, he wasn't staking a claim to, you know, a pure West or a pure cowboy, anything, but was aware of, yeah, that, like, the romance of it, the mythology of it, the image of it is also the real thing. And he told me, he's like, look, go over to the highway and see all those people with horse trailers. Those are people playing cowboy. And, like, that keeps it alive. So, like, yeah, I think that he just had a good understanding and self-awareness of that, which made it accessible, interesting. You could kind of enter into it, I think, as a listener.
Yeah. And he was a big reader. Like, he would read local history. He would talk extensively with people, try to get, like, MC Horses, for example, is overheard conversation between cowboys, right, about the closing of the MC Ranch. And he was very interested in the history of the West, the history of horses, history of cowboys, that kind of thing. And he researched it.
Yeah. And very particular histories, very particular narratives. Like you said, he would name names that no one in this room has heard of, and, like, most of his listeners never heard of, but he's going to write a song about it because so-and-so knows the back roads of Nevada. And if you want to see the, you know, the Old West in Nevada, you go with this guy. And he'll write a song. Okay, Ross, or no, Blaine somebody. I don't even know these names. But
There's a lot of them.
Yeah, so he was very precise in his research, which I found interesting. It wasn't just a general... Yeah. Cowboy.
Right.
So he goes, in 1985, Tyson performed at the National Cowboy Poetry Gathering in Elko, Nevada. This is a yearly event. It features all kinds of cowboy, like, arts and crafts and culture. And he played there and he was a hit.
Yeah. And this was, I think he went down the first year that it happened. And this thing kind of came about because of this cowboy renaissance of, like, cowboys becoming cool again. But there was, like, this folk tradition, this oral Western tradition of these cowboys reading poetry.
I've heard of it. I'd heard of it before. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. And so he went down with his songs, which he'd already recorded, and he's like, oh, people actually like this stuff.
Yeah.
There's people who are into this.
Right. And those are, like, the real cowboy fans, obviously. Mm-hmm. In 1986, Twyla gave birth to a girl, Adelita Tyson. Later that year, Ian and Twyla got married. They're living together on the ranch, though, already, right? Okay, in 86, Tyson released what would be his most successful solo album, Cowboyography. So the title is taken from cowboy poet Gail Gardner. Cowboyography is a combination of the words cowboy and geography. Now, that makes perfect sense, but all the places cowboys go, right? But that word, when I encounter it, just my first impression is cowboyography is the study of cowboys. Mm. And that's how I'm like, yeah, that makes sense for this album.
Yeah, totally. I never thought of it.
Okay. Tyson proudly stated that he refused government funding to record and produce this record and others, right? Mm-hmm. Instead, he had two wealthy friends who could fund it. It's nice when that happens.
That helps, right? Yeah.
The album features his best-known solo song, Navajo Rug, about a romantic encounter at a diner. And there's also a song called Claude Dallas, a specific reference, a contemporary story of a man in prison for having killed two game wardens in Idaho, and who then broke out of prison.
And We're on the Lam, I think, when he was performing this. He said it was a contentious song to be playing in certain
because
places.
Claude Dallas was actually out and about, like an outlaw, as he was singing the song around.
Yeah.
The album was released by Tyson himself on his own label, Eastern Slope Records, before labels picked it up. So it kind of feels like a very much a DIY kind of effort in a lot of ways. It benefited from word of mouth and strong radio play. The album would go platinum in Canada. That's 100,000 copies. And I guess you'd say kick-started the second act of his career as pure country musician. Should we listen to Navajo Rug? I mean, everybody knows the song.
Everyone knows it. We could sing it. Just kidding. Yeah.
Let's listen to 1 minute. 1 minute of Navajo Rug. Let's do it.
Well, it's two eggs up on whiskey toast, home fries on the side. Wash it down with the roadhouse coffee, burns up your insides. You're just a canyon caller at a diner, and a waitress I did love. I sat in the back beneath an old stuffed bear and a worn out Navajo rug. Now old Jack, the boss, he left at 6. Then it's Katie, bar the door. She'd pull down that Navajo rug and she'd spread it across the floor. Hey, I saw lightning cross the sacred mountain, saw the woven turtle doves. But I was lying next to Katie on that old Navajo rug. Aye, 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 Katie, shades of red and blue. Aye, 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 Katie, whatever became of the Navajo rug and you?
I didn't know what whiskey toast was. I had to look, I'm like, so is there whiskey on toast? That sounds terrible.
What is it?
It's rye bread.
Okay. I was like, I don't know if I know either.
It's a reference to like rye being like whiskey's made of rye.
Okay.
So they call rye bread
whiskey bread.
Whiskey bread or whiskey toast.
Mm. Okay.
That's what I mean, the internet tells me this. That's what I know.
Well, from now on.
It's not as cool as it, like, oh no, this is like toast with whiskey and like a shot of whiskey.
It would be nice if there is toast, then you could have butter mixed with whiskey.
Yeah,
whipped
yeah.
with whiskey.
Wow.
Then spread on the toast.
On the whiskey toast.
Yeah.
On the rye.
There's a kind of thing. They might do that at the Longview Steakhouse.
Yeah,
now.
Maybe. I don't know.
I might make that later.
Tyson has a long career as a country musician after this, essentially. He keeps putting albums out. I'm just trying to think what I should highlight here. I mean, he plays at the opening ceremonies of the Winter Olympics in Calgary in 1988 alongside Gordon Lightfoot. He has in the 90s, he's getting older now, right? He has a serious bout of pneumonia, which meant that he had to change his drinking habits. He wasn't able to drink whiskey any longer. So he started drinking white wine instead, which is funny. That's what a doctor told him to do. Like a doctor's like, drink wine.
Yeah.
Drink wine.
It's good for you.
In 2002, he opened a coffee shop in Longview called Navajo Mug. And I guess,
I've been there.
Oh, you went?
Oh, you've been there.
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
What was it like?
It's a coffee shop.
did you get a mug?
No, I wish.
I wish too, because I went there too, and then I'm like, and it doesn't exist anymore, and I have no
paraphernalia.
Paraphernalia.
Like not a shirt or anything.
No.
Yeah. In the 2000s, he was involved in several conservation efforts in southern Alberta, including like an effort to stop the building of a dam on the Old Man River.
Yeah, yeah.
Which was not successful. But he mentions, there's more in there about a few other causes, like industrial development on a nearby ranch.
Yeah,
right?
In the Eastern Slopes, which Corb Lund has continued that fight, which is interesting. When you think, we were talking about Vietnam War before.
Yeah.
He was averse to, like, I don't know, explicit political statements, I suppose, except that later on, as he was in Alberta and these things were happening on the land, he was getting involved. And he was, I remember him saying, like, he was frustrated when people that he was cowboying with did not care about that stuff. Because he's like, you know, we need to preserve this. So he was political.
Yeah, he was.
In that sense.
Yeah, in the end, he was. In 2005, Four Strong Winds is chosen in a CBC poll as the greatest Canadian song.
Mm-hmm. Some, yeah, CBC.
It was a CBC
vote, listener vote type deal.
That's right, yeah. Twyla and Ian were growing apart. They, you know.
She was too old for him.
Yikes. They officially divorced in 2008, but I think they'd been estranged in the kind of... It was a complicated divorce. Tyson, you know, mentions... I mean, he complains about having lost half of everything, including his song.
Sounds like a country song.
Still half everything. I don't think... Yeah, in his, to his credit, he does not sing that song, I don't think. Not that specifically. Their daughter, Adelita, was an accomplished rider, and she competed as a barrel racer on the rodeo circuit. Now, in 2010, Tyson published a biography, ghostwritten by Jeremy Clausus. He's also featured in a documentary called From the Gravel Road. And the next year, he co-published another biography with Sylvia about the Ian and Sylvia years. So what accounts for this flurry of publicity, activity, publishing, and whatnot at this point in his life in 2010? My guess is that financial concerns, maybe after his divorce, he was thinking, maybe I'll make a bit more money doing this stuff.
Okay. And I think he said that on the book tour.
Oh, really?
Why did you write this book? I needed the money.
Fair.
He was pretty upfront about it. So you got to appreciate the transparency.
Yeah.
Are you familiar with the 2011 book about Ian and Sylvia?
I actually just picked it up from Fair's Fair like 2 months ago.
Oh, okay.
So I haven't read it yet, but I'm curious too.
Yeah. Yeah. So we're getting to the end here. What should I say? Tyson's voice changed in later years. So in the mid-2000s, he heard his voice at one point. I mean, I guess it was just worn out after so many years singing.
Yeah, which gave... And he struggled with that. He didn't like his voice after it changed. But I think it gave his music like a new register. On the first album after that happened, I think it's called Yellowhead to Yellowstone.
Great album.
It is a fantastic album. And there's songs on there, namely the title track, which is about these wolves that are taken to Yellowstone, relocated.
Yeah.
And he's singing about, you know, this journey and then being alone and dying and like these great themes, and he's singing it in this ragged voice, and it just gives it like more resonance.
Yeah, that's a great album. I listened to that because you wrote about it. You mentioned that song in your Sprawl article.
Mm, yeah,
yeah. Let's see here. So in 2015, Tyson released his final full album. That was called Vaquero Carnero, right?
Mm-hmm. Vaquero, maybe. Yeah, one or the other. Yeah.
And I listened to that just yesterday, and I thought it was really good. I guess in 2015, I suppose it was after that album, he had a heart attack, and I think his health suffered after that. But Tyson writes in this memoir, you know, about receiving regular visits from fellow Albertan country music icon Corb Lund. And in his later years, Tyson and Lund would sometimes perform together, including, you know, on Tyson's 1994 song MC Horses. So Corb Lund does a cover of it, and there's a wonderful YouTube video of them performing it together. And in Tyson, this is maybe in 2017 or something like that. In 2019, Tyson featured on the Corb Lund track Ride On. And again, there's a video for that as well. And all Ian Tyson does is say Ride On. That's all. So
it's interesting. Yeah. I just want to jump in because it was interesting watching the two of them together when I was working on the book. At one point, one day I came out to the Stone House and Corb was staying over there.
Oh, okay.
And it was a very interesting dynamic because Ian was ranting about something, and I'm trying to remember what the issue was. I think it was like industrial development or like maybe grasslands in the U.S. or something like this. Anyway, he was kind of going off.
Yeah.
And Korb kind of acted as his fact checker. He was like, where'd you hear that? are you sure about that? And so it was kind of this interesting, just seeing the two of them together.
Interesting.
And how obviously Korb reveres Ian and has modeled a great deal of his career off the influence of Ian Tyson, but also just to see kind of the playfulness and the fact checking.
It's wonderful to see them play MC horses together. Ian, because Ian's his voice isn't what it used to be. You could tell he doesn't have quite all the breath. So he sings the first few lines of the chorus, and then Korb comes in and sings the rest, and then goes back to Ian. And it's just a really wonderful thing to see.
A beautiful,
To see them perform that way together. So Ian Tyson died on his ranch east of Longview, December 29th, 2022. He was 89. And Jeremy wrote a wonderful obituary. If you haven't read it, you should go read it in the Sprawl. So are there any audience questions or comments?
I want to thank you guys for bringing ghost towns and ghost writers, that kind of influence for Canadian arts and cultures. But do you think, because you mentioned Tyson, he refused at some point in time funding for his work and music and stuff like that. Do you think we need more? Do you think they should, get more funding for that from the government? Or thank you.
Yeah, that's a good question.
Tyson says no.
Yeah, Tyson says no, he won't take it. But I think certainly, and I don't know Korb Lund, somebody like that, their stance on it. But for most musicians now, record sales aren't a thing anymore, right? So even that stream of revenue is not available. So I don't know. I think even folk musicians I know now, it's they're applying for grants. Those grants you're talking about, that funding, because it is essential if they're gonna do what they're doing.
Yeah, and it's interesting also, Aaron, you said that it wasn't because he was selling so many albums that he didn't need funding. It was because he had benefactors, patrons, as it were.
Yeah.
So, and now it's even harder because, you really can't make a living selling records. You really have to have public funding.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There isn't going to be much Canadian arts and culture without public funding. And it's even increasing the case with journalism too. I mean, this is much more contentious, I would say, but the funding of, the National Post or something, we're giving them tens of millions. Really just, it is a weird moment in the media generally, arts and culture as a subset of the media.
Yeah, people expect stuff for free.
Yeah.
And they're not going to pay for it, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, so how do you balance that? Yeah, that these are big questions.
Yeah. Mm. Any other questions or comments? Thank you.
So I have no excuse. I'm from Alberta, and I knew nothing. And I don't recognize the Navajo. I almost said Navajo mug. But anyway, I don't recognize Navajo rug either. But, when you were reflecting on when you, first became aware of Ian Tyson or whatever, I was watching Festival Express. And I was, an adult, and I born and raised in Alberta, and it was there's this train going across Canada in the late 60s, early 70s, and Janis Joplin's on board, Andy Garcia, the band is there and stuff, and Ian and Sylvia.
Yeah.
And I was afterwards, I was who are these Ian and Sylvia people? And people in Calgary were just incensed. They're like, what do you mean? You don't know, Ian Tyson? You don't know Ian and Sylvia? Anyway, so in this conversation, which was really fascinating, I didn't hear anything about that. And I thought, is it them? Was it somebody else? Yeah. So I quickly Googled it. And it does appear that they were on that train, at least a portion of it, right?
That was with the band Great Speckled Bird.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. I think that's right.
And they definitely write about it, or someone writes about it as a like the party train. It sounded crazy.
Yeah, I can only imagine what, with quite a lineup for that time to be all in one place.
Yeah.
One train.
That's one train.
It's a party train.
Yeah, party train. I think that they kept having to stop and like not just refuel the train, but go get more whiskey. I believe it was mostly whiskey that they were having to bring on for Janis Joplin, the likes of Janis Joplin, et cetera. And I do know one person who saw Joplin and McMahon during the Festival Express because they actually stopped in Calgary. But anyway, any reflections or anything that maybe Tyson revealed about that experience, I guess?
He has an anecdote about getting in a fight.
Yeah, he got in a fight outside the Cecil Hotel, apparently on that tour.
Okay.
And broke his hand.
Yeah, and broke his hand.
Right, right. And then he couldn't play.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, like, there's that. It's interesting because that was also a little stint where that band was playing, Great Speckled Bird, which didn't last long. They made one record.
Yeah.
And so it was kind of this blip. It'd be interesting to see. There must be footage. I wonder if there's like Calgary, specifically Calgary.
Yeah, there is. Rewatch Festival Express. I have it somewhere on DVD, but people don't really use DVDs anymore. So anyway, thank you.
Thanks. Yeah, thank you.
I have a question
for
Jeremy.
Yeah.
Well, what was it like working with the Anti-Sin?
Intimidating.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was good for the most part. It was intimidating going out there the first time and being like, okay. And I told my editor, I'm like, I do not know anything about horses. I'm uncomfortable around horses. I don't know anything about ranches. And she's like, doesn't matter. We just need like a body, like who can hold a tape recorder. And so you'll be fine. Go do it. But like we hit it off pretty well. He was cantankerous. He was a cantankerous guy. So I remember like I'd bring him a draft of like a chapter. And like, I can't remember what chapter it was, but like he did not like this draft.
Oh.
And I remember him reading it and I'm like sitting on the couch in the stone house and he's at his big desk. And I just remember him like with his hands on his desk looking at it. And then he just looks over at me. And I'm like, wow. But, you know, as ghostwriters do, as you know, then it's like, okay, what are we going to do? Where are you getting hung up? Let's work on it.
Yeah.
So it was cool. My one regret is that I didn't get a photo with him. This was like pre-smartphone. And I had in my head that this would be like unprofessional to get a photo.
Yeah.
Or like, I don't know.
How much time did you actually spend with them?
It was like driving down to the Stone House like two or three times a week. And then like about 2 hours each time in the morning.
Like for a few months?
Yeah, it was about 3 months.
Okay, wow.
I think. Yeah. So, yeah, it was quite a while.
Yeah, that's so interesting. Sounds fun and intimidating.
These days, you'd start an Instagram feed that was just me writing Ian Tyson's.
Yeah.
Look, except he would fire you immediately.
Check out the longhorns. Longhorn selfie. Yeah, exactly.
There'd be a ton of that. That's right. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
All right, well, here we are at the end of the show. I just want to ask.
Oh, we have one more question.
Oh, we do? Here. Oh, yeah, please come up.
I guess related to the just previous discussion, how did you find the tension as like a memorist writing the, I guess, like subject's perspective versus maybe the reality that you were able to see and like find the right balance between story and purpose and like, I guess, direct facts that you can validate?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's a good question. It was interesting because there were gaps where he did not want to get into certain parts of the story. It's like, okay, so what do you do as a ghostwriter? So for me, it meant like researching and pulling some old articles and whatnot and kind of cobbling together a bit of the story. I mean, like as a ghostwriter, you are tasked with telling this story as the person wants it told. So, yeah, I kind of was mindful mindful of that going in. There was parts where he felt it was like too much of a downer in the book. It was, and to be honest, like, he was isolated at the time I was working on the book with him. Like, he was recently divorced. He was living alone with his, at his ranch. And so, yeah, it was kind of a sad period. He was estranged from his daughter and, like, yeah. But he was like, okay, let's liven this up. Like, this is too much of a downer here. But yeah, I don't know. Naomi, you might have insight as, like, in terms of balancing that as a ghostwriter.
Oh, yeah, like, sometimes the way... Well, I don't know. It doesn't sound like this really... I know I've had the experience of someone, like, having... of me having a very different take on what is going to come across well than the subject of the book or the, like, author of the book. And sometimes, like, it's just where the emphasis lies, like... I don't know, like in this book, and we can edit this out if you want, but like he does talk about women in a way that's like a little bit old-fashioned.
Demeaning, yeah. Yeah, old-fashioned, sure.
Yeah, demeaning, offensive, maybe you could say. And I wondered about that, like if that was, if you'd even like toned that down or like if, like the kinds of like, even like, you know, the way he's like, I was trying to get into this great-looking gal's pants or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I wonder what else he said that didn't make it into the book or like, you know.
And I'm trying to, and I'm trying to remember, like, because the book was kind of like copying and pasting from tape, like this, the transcript, and then like trying to make it readable and flow and whatnot. So it is this weird mix of like, I wouldn't say that, but yeah. So this guy says it, and it's his book, so I guess, it's a kind of weird. There's, I was leafing through it again, like, after he died, and I was like, a few of these lines, I'm like, we really published that? like about Twyla, his second wife, he uses a cutting horse metaphor. He's like, I saw her and I cut her out of the herd. And I'm like, wow. And then my wife was like, I remember that line, like when you did it, like that line wasn't okay then.
It stood out. It stood out to me as well. Yeah. I was like, huh, all right.
But it tells you a lot about Ian Tyson that he would say that. But then like as a ghostwriter, sometimes you're like, but like, is it in his best interest that people know that he said that?
Yeah.
You know?
Totally.
Yeah, but it's not really your decision to make.
Yeah, it's like you're trying to capture this authentic voice.
Yeah. And like sometimes you can just put it in and then give it to them to read and they're like, yikes, I don't want to say that. But sometimes they're like, yep, that sounds fine to me.
Yeah, great. Fantastic. Yeah. Yeah, it's an interesting conundrum when doing
totally
these projects.
Is. Yeah.
Well, any final thoughts? On Ian Tyson, his music, his legacy?
I mean, my final thoughts would be, if you're going to choose one album, well, I'll give two albums. Lost Herd. Ian Tyson told me that was probably his best album.
That's 1999?
1999, yeah. And Yellowhead to Yellowstone. That'd be the other one that I would recommend. And those are two, like, looking at the expanse of his life, fairly recent albums, which I think says a lot about just him as an artist.
They were still good. It was still good. Yeah. Jeremy, anything, any like ongoing, upcoming projects you'd like to promote?
That's the only ghostwriting gig I could get. I could never get it. Maybe it wasn't good enough. Maybe people read it and were like this. No.
Oh, I doubt that very much.
No, I'm joking. Yeah.
They're not easy to come by, the right ghostwriting gig, you know?
No, exactly.
Yeah. So you want to promote yourself as a ghostwriter right now?
No. Yeah, get going as a ghostwriter again. Yeah. No, follow The Sprawl, which is the publication I publish.
Yeah.
Sprawlcast is the podcast.
Yeah.
I will promote myself as a ghostwriter.
a legit ghostwriter.
I am available for hire, but I'm expensive. I'll say that.
Maybe Cor Blund needs a ghostwriter.
Yeah, maybe.
Wonderful. Well, I'll just take this opportunity to plug our next show. Sunday, April 23rd, Sweater Weather Live talks ducks. not the animals, the graphic novel by Kate Beaton. Our special guest will be Calgary author Mark Lynch. That's Sunday, April 23rd, same place, same time. And looking forward to that. So
thank you all so much for coming.
Thank you so much for coming. Thank you to the Memorial Park Library, and I will see you next time.